Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, Research Coordinator for Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, broadcasting here from Seattle, Washington. We have in the studio today with us, again, Dr. Jonathan Wells, a biologist and a senior fellow at the Center for Science and Culture of Discovery Institute. He's recently published a new article in the peer-reviewed scientific journal Biocomplexity. This is an open-access scientific journal that is the leading forum for testing the scientific merits of intelligent design as an explanation for life. At the heart of the scientific controversy over ID are questions having to do with the role and origin of information in biological systems. And Dr. Wells' new article is titled, Membrane Patterns Carry Ontogenetic Information That Is Specified Independently of DNA, and it discusses the question of where we find information that is beyond the DNA in living embryos. And he's also talking about how this impacts the ability of Darwinian evolution to explain the origin of information in life. So we had another podcast recently on this topic with Dr. Wells, and this is now the second in a series of four interviews where Dr. Wells is discussing his new paper. Again, we all know that DNA carries information, but as Dr. Wells explained in his first interview, DNA information in an embryo can only do its job in the context of spatial information that is specified independently of the DNA. And some of that information, that spatial information, is carried by the cell membranes. Today's interview is going to talk about membrane information in the form of a sugar code. And the next interview will deal with membrane information in the form of a bioelectric code. And then we're going to close it up with a discussion that will discuss what all this means for the ability of Darwinian evolution to explain embryo development. So Dr. Wells, thanks for coming back on the show with us here.
Happy to be here, Casey.
So this has been a really fascinating conversation. I can say right now that I get a lot of emails from the outside world. People often email me for papers that are discussing information that is carried in living organisms outside of the DNA. They are interested in hearing about this topic, and I'm really actually very grateful that you have taken the time to write and publish this paper in Biocomplexity, because I think it's answering a question a lot of people have about this topic. Would you agree that, I mean, people are interested in this question of where information resides outside of DNA?
Well, it's certainly something I have been interested in for many years. When I did my graduate study in biology at the University of California at Berkeley in the early 90s, I worked on frog embryos. Frog egg, as I said in the first interview, has what's called an animal-vegetal axis, sort of top to bottom, but it's symmetrical around that axis. When the sperm enters the egg, the inside of the egg rotates about 30 degrees relative to the outside. And it's this rotation called cortical rotation that actually sets up the other body axes of the embryo. Otherwise, it would just be a blob. And what happens during cortical rotation is information is moved from the vegetal pole at the bottom 30 degrees up one side of the embryo. And you could actually cut out a piece of the membrane at that spot and transplant it into another embryo and produce a twin. That is a tadpole that's basically a conjoined twin, two body axes. So the membrane and its associated cytoskeleton there carries information for embryo development. And you can do this without none of the DNA is affected. In fact, this whole process can take place with the nucleus removed from the egg. You have to put it back in afterwards or nothing happens, but it's not the DNA that's doing this. And so this got me interested in this whole topic of membrane information that's outside of the DNA.
Those were experiments that you were doing when you were a graduate student, and this sort of tipped you off to the fact that information is carried beyond the DNA. Is that essentially right?
Yes, I was not the first one to do these experiments. People have been doing them for many decades, but I did do those experiments as part of my research, and it fascinated me. The membrane or the cortex could carry information apart from that that's in the DNA.
So let's now discuss the question of the sugar code. What is the sugar code and why is it different from the code that's in DNA?
Well, the sugar code is one form that membrane information takes. It's not what's at work in the frog embryo I just described. But the fact is that the surfaces of all cells are covered with complex sugar molecules. They're called glycans. And what's interesting about sugar molecules, glycans, is that they can be combined in very complex ways. If you think of the nucleotides in DNA in a living cell, they're strung together linearly, one after the other. The same, with a few exceptions, is true of proteins. The amino acids are put together linearly. There's four nucleotides, so if you put six of them together in a line and do the math, there's about 4,000 ways you can put them together. There's 20 or so amino acids, so if you do that with six amino acids, there's about 60 million ways you can put them together. But the simple sugars that make up the sugar code, even though there are a few of them than there are amino acids, each have multiple places where another sugar molecule can be attached. For example, glucose, a simple sugar, has six places. So instead of being put together in linear chains, they can be put together in very complex branching molecules. So if you take six simple sugars and put them together in all the ways you can put them together, you can make something like a trillion different molecules. What's called the glycome, glyco is the Greek word for sweet, the glycome is far more information dense than the proteome and the genome put together. The DNA and the protein carry much less information.
That's really incredible. So where is this sugar code found in living cells?
It's found on the cell surface. Glycans can be attached to lipids. Those are called glycolipids, or to proteins in the membrane. Those are glycoproteins. And these glycans on the cell surface are the primary interface between that cell and other cells. There's a lot of cell-cell communication that goes on in an embryo, and the sugar code is instrumental in making sure that happens right. Furthermore, inside the cell, most proteins are glycosylated. That is, they have a glycan molecule attached to them. And this helps to make sure that that protein ends up in the right place in the cell because its location is like real estate, location, location, location. Where the protein is makes all the difference in its function.
So how did biologists obtain evidence for the sugar code, and what is some of that evidence?
Well, it's actually not easy. Standard biochemical methods are problematic because these branching sugar molecules, these glycans, are so complicated. So you can do biochemical work on DNA and proteins much more easily than you can on glycoproteins or glycolipids. What has been useful in many cases are antibodies. These are proteins that recognize the shapes of other molecules. Our immune system uses antibodies to recognize and fight off invading bacteria and viruses. And biochemists have made antibodies that recognize certain shapes in these glycoproteins and glycolipids. And so using antibodies that are also labeled with, a fluorescent label, biologists have identified patterns in the membranes of various kinds of cells and embryos that are mediated by these sugar molecules. Another way they've approached the problem is they can mutate the protein to which the glycan is attached, and so modify the membrane pattern. Doesn't help the cell, but it lets the biologists see where the glycans are located. And so that's been a useful technique as well.
What are the organisms that you're experimenting on when you're doing this kind of research?
Well, the most common ones are frogs, chick embryos, sometimes zebrafish embryos. Of course, fruit fly embryos are a favorite because fruit flies are so small and they multiply so rapidly. But when we want to study a mammal, we use a mouse.
So let's get back to glycans here. How do cells communicate through the glycan molecules?
A principal way they communicate is with the help of other molecules called lectins. Lectins are proteins. They're not antibodies. That is, they're not part of the immune system. They're not enzymes, which can actually affect chemical reactions. But like antibodies and enzymes, lectins recognize shapes of other molecules, specifically sugar molecules, by means of what's called a carbohydrate recognition domain. So lectins can form lattices with the glycoproteins or glycolipids on the cell surface and mediate thereby the cell's communication with other cells.
Can you give us some examples of lectins involved in embryo development?
Sure. Lectins are known to be regulated both in time and space in frog embryos. Recent work has shown that a network of two lectins interact with cell surface glycans that regulate skeletal development in chick limbs. And so by working on these embryos, which is not good for the embryo, unfortunately, but we do learn a lot by keeping track of these lectins and seeing that they're involved in these cell-cell communications that are essential to development.
Would you say that all cases of cell-to-cell communication involve lectins?
Not all, no. In fact, we know of one good case in fruit flies where we're talking about now fertilization, because so there's an egg and a sperm. The tip of the head of the sperm carries an enzyme in this case, not a lectin, that specifically recognizes a particular glycan. Well, that glycan is located on the surface of the egg. In fact, it's located specifically on something called the micropyle, which is a narrow tube at the anterior end of the egg through which the sperm will enter. So these two molecules, the enzyme and the glycan, seem to be involved in sperm-egg recognition and therefore in fertilization.
So this is pretty important stuff for reproduction of species.
Absolutely. Because glycan molecules are so complex, they can be very specific. So, you know, the sperm from one species won't recognize a glycan on the egg of another and prevents a lot of confusion.
Wow. So do you see the sugar code as a promising area for future research and understanding embryology?
I do, because it's so universal on cells, so important in development, and yet it has been relatively neglected over the past few decades for two reasons. One is there's been a lot of emphasis on DNA because of the theory of evolution. And as I said earlier, DNA and protein is easier to work with biochemically than these complex carbohydrates. So there's a lot of progress still to be made, and progress is being made. New techniques are being developed that hold a lot of promise for future research in this area.
Well, thank you, Dr. Wells. This has been a really fascinating discussion, and I appreciate the work you've done both to write this paper and also to communicate some of these complicated concepts to our listeners, I think, in a very easy to understand manner. So again, the article that we're talking about is a new peer-reviewed paper by Dr. Jonathan Wells titled "Membrane Patterns Carry Ontogenetic Information That Is Specified Independently of DNA." You can download the whole article for free and read it online at www.bio-complexity.org. That's the website of the Biocomplexity Journal. So Dr. Wells, thanks for continuing this conversation with us.
Happy to do it, Casey.
We're going to continue talking about extra DNA information that's carried in membranes of living organisms in the next podcast. So stay tuned for more with Dr. Jonathan Wells. I'm Casey Luskin. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.